Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Danielle DiMartino Booth and Ira Harris. Danielle is founder and CEO of Quill Intelligence, which provides innovative leadership on how market intelligence is conceived and delivered. She's the author of Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. She has a column also on Bloomberg View, business speaker, and a commentator frequently featured in many media outlets. Prior to Quill, Danielle spent 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, where she served as advisor to President Richard Fisher throughout the financial crisis. And Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also recently. Welcome, Danielle and Ira.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Good to be here.
Great. I thought we'd begin with your thoughts, Danielle, on the economy, what's happened from the COVID crisis and how central bank and government actions are acting on the lockdown's challenges?
Well, so I think that what we need to appreciate and understand is that COVID is dictating what's happening in the labor force in America, and that in turn, from that follows that what's happening in the labor market is going to determine what happens with the economic recovery or lack thereof. So I think a recognition of the fact that the virus is in the driver's seat is really critical. So if you look at the data that came out today from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Department of Labor, they're literally in different zip codes, even though both statistical agencies are theoretically in Washington, D.C. One of the measures, the unemployment rate, fell to 11.1% theoretically in the month of June. And I would be specific and say that the survey week for that data ended June 13th. When you look over at the other side of the statistical agency, at the Department of Labor data, we get real-time state unemployment insurance recipients and pandemic unemployment assistance recipients, and any other form of emergency benefits. But again, this is a hard, absolute number of Americans collecting some form of unemployment insurance as of the June 13th timestamp. And you get 31.5 million Americans. That is a record post-COVID high that represents 19.1% of the U.S. workforce that was 164.6 million people as of February 2020. So you have a huge disparity in between what an agency that uses a lot of seasonal adjustment is reporting compared to what another agency is reporting based, again, purely on the number of Americans collecting unemployment checks.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I agree with Danielle's perspective on this. First of all, I'm wondering, you know, and I'll say it again, the data is meaningless anyway, because, you know, I posed a question. If we come to December, and I'm still optimistic, I'm not optimistic, but I view this as an optimistic forecast. If you had 9% unemployment and 6% inflation, do you think the Fed would pivot? And if you don't think so, then what data is meaningless. Because as I want to say, and some people get upset, but I'm only using Powell's own words. When he says that all these people who have lost their jobs through, and he says this over and over, through no fault of their own. Now, I'm not here to lock up with the Fed over a moral argument, because morally, we all agree with that. But that makes the Fed's policy a social justice policy. As soon as you say through no fault of their own, now you're going to be on this path come hell or high water. Because how can you pull the rug out from whatever recovery is taking place by pivoting when it's no fault of their own? So to me, the data, you know, and I was listening to CNBC this morning, and it's still Wall Street versus Main Street. Okay, Wall Street applauds this because they know the Fed will be a liquidity provider in one way or another. And even though there hasn't been a complete uptake of what they promised, there is massive amounts of funding, I believe, coming to state, county, and municipal governments through the Fed. Because that's going to be the next step, as well as some other things. The Republicans, through Trump, are trying to put a little pressure so as not to provide as much fiscal stimulus so they can look like they're standing up to the Democrats. Believe me, I think they're going to come with a full throttle. They're going to open up that and just full speed ahead. So I agree with Danielle, because that's what you're seeing. The numbers are meaningless. Let's get on, because the Fed has locked themselves into this situation.
Well, you know, so Ira, I'm gonna push back for just a second, and I'm not pushing back for the sake of pushing back.
No, good. That's what we should do.
No, I completely agree that the Fed's not gonna pull back at all. But not a single Fed program that's been implemented has any strictures that dictate that you have to keep employees on the payroll. Not a single one. So all they're doing is throwing money at companies. And if you look at the most extreme, and this is not a company that is being assisted in any way by the Federal Reserve, indirectly, American Airlines is being assisted by the Federal Reserve because borrowing costs are so artificially low. But American Airlines took a direct bailout and announced today that in the fall, they know that they will not need 20,000 of their current employees, given what their fall schedule is looking like. And that's code word for saying on September the 30th, the bailout that we took from Uncle Sam expires and we can start firing people. And by the way, we borrowed $2 billion of debt care of the Fed, keeping interest rates at artificially low levels, and we're still going to go bankrupt.
I agree with you. And then, you know, it's like everybody forgets Cirque du Soleil, which is a program that I love. They're in bankruptcy. They've got, 15,000 employees? And, you know, and there's a negative feedback loop to all that, too. Because, you know, there is a multiplier effect that we know. Just like there's a positive multiplier effect, there's a negative multiplier effect. So I agree with you. All of this does impact. And, right, they've kept people on. And now Kudlow comes out and says, well, we can, you know, we're going to cut the unemployment allowances and make them employment generated. Okay. But, again, it's... You radically went from 3.5% unemployment up to, let's say 17% unemployment, whatever the official numbers were. We'll eventually find that out. But even if you settle in at 9%, how are you going to get people? You know, the savings numbers are up big, but that's a classic Ricardian response to the turmoil that people see ahead of them. And as Danielle, before we started recording, as you talked about, you're in Texas. So, I mean, you're certainly seeing it, and it's going to affect the way that people spend and approach the unknowns as we motor ahead here.
Look, I think it is impossible to quantify at this point the detrimental effect to the United States economy vis-a-vis the rest of the world, because we didn't have a coordinated response to the coronavirus. Goldman Sachs came out with a report that said, this is a few days ago, this is before California shut down 19 counties, and this is before the bars in Miami were closed. Who's coming to Miami
Miami Beach if there's no bar open. And this is before Nashville stepped back and closed its bars and restaurants. So, but at that point, it was 40% of U.S. GDP that was in the process of reclosing. And what that means is if you're an employee who had been furloughed and asked to come back to work, you're being re-furloughed, or worse, you're being laid off permanently. And this is all because there was not a coordinated response to the coronavirus at a national level that would have helped the country go up the curve and come down the curve, as opposed to go up the curve and come down the curve in the state of New York and New Jersey and have the curve continue flying in the rest of the country. But this, the economic price, it's impossible to say. But Ira, to your point about Cirque du Soleil and bankruptcy filings, let's put some meat on that bone, because the Fed's programs are expressly to prevent insolvencies in theory. And yet, through June, companies with $50 million or more in liabilities, 128 of them filed Chapter 7 or Chapter 11. The closest year we have is 2009. The first 6 months of 2009, when we were deep in recession, 171 companies declared bankruptcy then. And this is prior to the economy starting to live off of the oxygen of quantitative easing that prevented insolvencies after that point. But despite what the Fed is doing, we still have 128 bankruptcies through the first 6 months of the year. Lord knows what we'll see in the second 6 months, even again, as the Federal Reserve throws good money after bad.
I agree with everything that you're talking about, because they are just throwing money at it. And you know what? It's not even infrastructure projects. You know what? Shame on all of them not to have some type of plan well ahead of this, because they all talked about it. So, you know, and I know that David Rosenberg and I kind of locked up on this the last time we were did a FIRA podcast, because, you know, he was adamant, well, it's 3.5% unemployment. Where are you going to find the workers? But they should have had a plan in place, roads, bridges, airports, so that they could institute it. Now you've got nothing but workers. And you know what? Now all you're doing is spending lots of cash and really not investing it. You're just sustaining, I think that's really what you're talking about.
Well, how on earth do you go into a crisis of this magnitude and not bring the two political parties together on day one to do infrastructure spending and put people to work immediately? How on earth do you avoid that when you're spending $3 trillion?
Yeah, I agree. That's really the crime of it all. They're in such a hurry, and it's just so, and then they applaud themselves. And I agree with you. You know, you talk about the Fed has prevented insolvencies. You know what? All the crisis isn't responsible for the debt crisis. The COVID crisis isn't responsible for the debt crisis. The Fed, it bears the responsibility for the debt crisis, for sustaining the vast amount of debt. The COVID crisis was just a catalyst. And now you're piling on more debt onto these companies who were burdened with it before. You know, you can claim, well, it's great that there's no insolvencies. But again, here we are, intertemporal misallocation. We just keep borrowing from the future, bringing it forward. And you know what? The future comes faster each time.
It does. And Richard, if I could follow on to what Ira's talking about, coming into 2020, the United States ended 2019 with non-financial debt to GDP of 74%. That is a post-war high. That is typically, that was the absolute high point of the financial crisis. Because when you go into crisis, your profits fall and your GDP declines, and therefore your debt goes up. It's just a numerator denominator phenomena. But going into the corona crisis, non-financial debt to GDP was at 74%. If you figure in what the consensus has penciled for Q2 GDP contraction of 35%, give or take, and then you add on to that what's documented, you can check it out on the Bloomberg if you want, the $2.5 trillion of debt that companies have tacked on so far in 2020. We're starting off the second half of 2020 with non-financial debt to GDP at 96%, 96% of GDP. These are simply unheard of figures that show you how hobbled corporate America is and dictate that liquidation is going to end up being the route taken by a lot of these companies because there's not going to be any value to salvage. There's not going to be any collateral left.
Would that also make it more difficult to actually do infrastructure spending from a fiscal stimulus perspective?
Not as long as we have the reserve currency dollar status.
Okay.
Or MMT.
Well, yes, that too. Well, we have MMT.
Yes, we do.
$2,400 a month is MMT.
Yeah, it is. And there's no fear of that this won't be able to pay back. We're here. You know, and everybody goes, oh, you know, why is the gold rallying? The gold is rallying because it's anticipating that. It's not anticipating inflation per se. It sees the malfeasance of central banks. And I'm sorry, where others applaud, well, if you're on Wall Street, you applaud it because there's no end to it. But if you're sitting in another seat, you go, I'm not so sure. And that's the world's viewpoint. And, you know, and I guess we'll get to a dollar discussion at some point. But
Yeah. So I just wanted to get your thoughts also, Danielle, on what you have written recently about Federal Reserve action, meaning the economy is no longer about innovation, but more about floating zombie companies. Can you elaborate on that? Do you see similarities with what's happened in Japan?
Absolutely. So, again, leaving the year 2019, we had about 14% of U.S. firms that were classified as zombie corporations. Their profit basically can't cover their interest expense. That's the easiest way to boil it down. And now we've got 1 in 5, 20% of American companies that are considered to be zombies. And that is definitely policy that is laid at the foot of the Fed. The Fed did a lot of things very quickly in the heat of the moment. I think it was expected that they take interest rates to the zero bound, even though that's not been proven to help a lot because the most creditworthy borrowers are always going to have low borrowing costs and uncreditworthy borrowers are always going to pay through the nose, regardless of where the Federal Reserve sets policy. But nevertheless, you have created these zombies now. And as I said before, you're going to displace future innovation. You're going to displace future entrepreneurship. You're going to increase and further entrench the monopolization of corporate America and cut off the ability for the economy to self-generate going forward because you're keeping capacity in the system that is simply taking up space, not creating jobs.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Oh, I agree with that. And then the government debt is growing by leaps and bounds with no investment. There's no investment here, so that adds on to it. And I know you have to do triage and you have to stop the bleeding, but now you've painted yourself in. You know, that's my problem with the Fed. There is no exit strategy, none. You know, even Lagarde at least put June 2021 as the possible end to their program. There is none. And you know, I hear Powell and others say, well, we can put the tools back in the tool box. And I don't see it because we have to remember that Powell pivoted in January 2019 with unemployment at 3.5%. And now he's made a promise. He's made a promise that through no fault of their own, those who were last hired and first fired will have, you know, it's the Fed's responsibility to create a situation where they will be back in the active job pool, working, you know, because he has said that. And I listened to that last Fed listens. It wasn't a podcast per se. It was it wasn't Zoom, but it was something else. But I listened and it was like a labor rally from when I was young, and I'm much older than Danielle is. but I may as well have been listening to George Meany or somebody else from the AFL-CIO, and because it was, that's what it was. And again, from a moral standpoint, I'm all about people getting jobs. But do I want the Fed to fill that role outside of providing the financial wherewithal? I don't need them advocating it openly. Just their policies should serve it.
You've recently predicted, Danielle, that this current crisis may result in a leaner workforces as a result of automation. Can you elaborate on that? And do you think this could create a certain percentage of the unemployed as being permanently unemployed, unable to obtain a job, as economist David Rosenberg has pointed out?
I think that what we're going to see in the United States is that even though we're not the low-cost labor leader, I'm talking about if you compare us to South America or Vietnam. So even though we're not the lowest cost labor in the world, we've had extremely low cost labor for generations that have enabled small businesses in America to hire employees because they could do so in a cost effective way. And that has been one of the things that has kept a lot of people employed, but not making a lot of money. It's because small businesses had an easy enough trade-off equation to do between investing in automation and human capital. Now that they've gone through what they've gone through, they are going, by force, they're going to find a way to substitute technology for labor. So the trend towards automation in medium and large-sized companies that was already well underway is now going to be pushed into the small business sector in America, such that in the future we have a minimization of human-to-human contact, and we have a greater acceptance as a consuming populace of automated transfers, whereas before we might have said, you know what, where are those bank tellers? Now we're like, I'm so happy I can do this automatically and there's no human-to-human contact. But that theory, that philosophy, that way of approaching business is going to trickle down into the small business community that employed 47% of Americans prior to COVID. And I think that the generational scar that it could leave on a very unskilled U.S. labor force is something that cannot be quantified at this point. But it's fair to say that if there's 1 in 5 Americans right now who are out of work, there's a good chance that if we go from 20% to 10% and we have a labor force participation rate as low as it has been for the past 12 years, take yet another step down and stay there for quite some time. Because you're talking about fixing it through political revolution, through educational reform in America. These things have been intractable challenges for our government for generations plural now. But that's what you're talking about. You're talking about having to reinvent an entire workforce in the world's biggest economy.
Yes. And your thoughts, Ira?
I can't agree more, because, and I'll go back before as Danielle did, When the unemployment numbers got so low and they were bringing people back to the workforce, which was a good thing, and everybody was, you know, first the question was after the Trump tax cuts, where's the capital expenditure, right? Everything went to stock buybacks, but there was very little capital expenditure. And I go, nobody's taking it on because they brought so much demand forward from the future. They would rather hire workers who, if things turn down, because there was so much uncertainty, even after the tax cuts, it's easier to get rid of workers than to have to deal with a $100 million factory or other such capital expenditures. It's easier to get rid of workers. And bingo, the COVID proved it. Look at how fast they could get rid of all these workers. And then the government picked it up, so that was a benefit of all. But now there's headaches to it. And how many do they want to call back? So I think Danielle is dead on target that you will now see capital expenditures, you know, once there's some greater certainty. And I don't mean the last tick in the stock market as an indication of certainty, by the way. But when there is some sense of, well, you know, we're getting back on our feet, I think workers will be slow to be rehired and capital expenditure will be at the forefront. And that will be a significant piece of this puzzle, especially because the Fed has now signed itself on to the employment situation. That is paramount. I can't tear it enough out of Powell. That is paramount. They are a social justice agency, as far as I'm concerned. And because of that, I think business will now, because of the uncertainty, be more apt for capital expenditure. So I'm in total agreement with Danielle.
And what do you make, Danielle, of the millennial socialism call for like a universal basic income, UBI?
Well, if you really want to quickly put an end to the United States superpower status, then you should go ahead and take that route.
Okay. Yeah.
Double the global debt from here and give the 34% of foreign holders of floating U.S. treasuries the excuse they've been looking for to no longer have to step up to auctions, because all of a sudden our debt levels are not in theory as high as they could be, but in practice as high as they are, and we end up giving up our position on the global stage economically.
Mm-hmm. And Ira?
Well, we can't engage that without now going to talk about who the hell is buying dollars in this environment. I'm just opening the door to that question.
Well, look, you bring up a conundrum, Ira. You bring up the fact that if we look at flows data, that we've seen two consecutive months of the largest selling on the parts of foreign owners of treasuries in the history of the data series. So typically it would work like clockwork. We would buy imported goods and they would thereby need to convert them into dollars. U.S. Domestic demand is collapsing, and we've also largely shut ourselves off to services exports. I'm talking about tourism and children, who college-age children, who my boys attend a military academy. A good portion of the student body is of these high schoolers is from China. So we're also cutting off the ability to need dollar conversion with our services industry. So you ask a good question, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I've been in, Danielle, I don't know, Rich, I don't know, probably for certainly, and I can trace it. I go back to May 24th. When Wolfgang Schäuble did a pivot by being Mr. Nine, actually said that there should be a euro bond to fund grants to the poorer European countries that had been so wrecked by COVID. And he said, as Adam Tooze aptly reported, but I'd read it in the FT, but Adam Tooze was one of the few who caught it, that Schäuble had said, look, if you make them loans, it's like giving them stones. You're just weighing them down with more debt. It's time to do grants, because that's like giving them bread. And I go, I had to read it three times. This is Wolfgang Schäuble saying that? That's, you know, that's Nixon going to China in 1972. It was such a dramatic turnaround. So from that moment on, I said, well, now Lagarde has a much more chance of prevailing here. She knows that they have to create a euro bond. It's either create a euro bond or end the facade. So, you know, I think that a euro bond would be a competitor to the U.S. and the Europeans in many ways went into this in better financial shape. And we'll come out of it in certain ways. The United States is just didn't. You know, it's not that they were in great. We weren't in great financial shape. Again, you know, we paid for a massive tax cut by loading on more debt. we had 2.5%, almost 3% GDP, and yet the deficit was growing to a trillion plus. And I know your relationship with Richard Fisher, and Richard Fisher had warned about that early on too, because it was pretty easy to see. Now it's only been compiled, and I understand very much about capital flows. I'm going, and I understand that we went through a period of late February, March, and early April with the massive shortage of dollars in the world because the emerging markets, especially, were carrying $11, $12 trillion in private sector dollar-denominated debt. So there was huge demand for dollars. And, of course, the Fed, little by little, they were late in opening up the swap lines to certain countries who needed dollars. But now the swap lines are being rolled back. So I just don't know why anybody would be looking to buy dollars, because I don't see anything positive right now. And that's with great uncertainty in the election cycle here. So this is what I'm looking at. I have some huge technical levels that are really in play. And how do I know that? Because they've proven to be, like in the euro, the 200-week moving average has been a great pivot. We've gotten above it a little bit, but it has held as resistance. And we got almost there this morning, pulled back again. So the levels are there. What will prompt it? I don't know. If I know the Fed can't talk about the dollar, it's not their bailiwick. Their policies can certainly affect a lower dollar. And Mnuchin doesn't say anything about it. Trump had demanded a lower dollar, and then all of a sudden in late April, early May, he started talking about the benefits of a strong dollar, which I didn't understand. The last thing the world needs now is a strong dollar. It would benefit immensely from a weaker dollar. So that's where my focus is. And based on everything that Danielle's talked about, I think that's the next piece of the puzzle that has to be looked at.
And just a last question in terms of your views, Danielle, on yield curve control and negative interest rates. What are your thoughts?
Well, negative interest rates, I would have to say, I have a stock answer. And you know Peter Bookvar, and I'm very good friends with Peter Bookvar. And I would just say, see Exhibit A, Japanese Bank Stock Index, and Exhibit B, Europe's Bank Stock Index, and come to the very quick conclusion that it is nonsensical. So we should not go there. It's been an utter failure. As far as yield curve control goes, it worked in the United States around the World War II era. It has not done anything for Japan. And again, if you're talking about trying to spur lending in America, you would look to the benchmark, theoretically, you would look to the 10-year. And that gets me to my rhetorical question of, what are you going to anchor the 10-year yield at? 0.5%? So at some point, it becomes an exercise in futility. And I think that the Fed has recognized that at this point. I think the more obvious route to take the next time that there's, oh, I don't know, a 5% correction in the stock market, it's more likely than not that we'll see the Fed come in and buy stocks.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, there was a Bloomberg article this week and going back a little further, you know, the savings rate is up dramatically. It's a classic Ricardian equivalence as far as I'm concerned. People are scared and they're hoarding money, and nobody's hoarding more money than the wealthy, because they can't spend, and I saw that study. As usual, those at the lowest end, consume every dollar that they have, and they're never prepared because they can't. That's their survival. But some of the numbers are down, and I know myself, my spending is dramatically off. Even when I want to spend, I can't spend. I can't go to ball games. I don't go out to restaurants. We go out and we prepare food. It's very difficult. How many times can you go to Amazon and order the same thing, meaning shoes, clothes? No, I'm not going anywhere. So it's hard. And that savings rate has to be scaring the Fed. Has to be. Because that's what, it's going to become a very sticky situation. classic Keynes paradox of thrift. So if the savings rate stays elevated, and I mean extremely elevated, will that prompt the Fed to go to negative interest rates? Because I mean, the only thing to negative interest rates, and I agree with everything Danielle said, and I've had long talks with Peter Bookmeyer about it because I'm very fond of Peter, and we talk quite a bit. But in order to get that money circulating, but you can't go to 10 basis points, negative 10 basis points, because that's the Japanese technique, and that hasn't been. You're going to have to you either go bigger or go home, because if that's what you're going to try to do, is to try to force people. You know, it's the whole same with electronic money. I know why they want electronic money, because then you go to negative 5% interest rates. You can't take it out and hoard it in your mattress. You can't hoard cash. You could take that money and buy gold, but we know the government always has an answer to that ultimately, too, if they view that as a deflationary piece. And I'm not in the deflation camp, by the way, because I believe the Fed has shown, along with the Treasury, they will go to any extreme to prevent the onset of deflation. So, but they want some velocity to all this cash. And when I look at it, yield curve control won't do it. And you know what? We go back to 46 to 51 following the war. That was, you know, the environment, the global environment was so vastly different, as well as the domestic environment. So you could do certain things that you can't do now. And money didn't flow as freely because, of course, there were capital controls all over the place. This is going to get interesting. And really, I know because of Danielle's experience with the Dallas Fed that she has a good insight on the yield curve. There's no trade. And somebody wrote a piece, maybe it was I know who it was. My mind wrote an interesting piece that if you do this, when your bond market stops trading, then your currency stops depreciating. And that's not a good thing, by the way, especially when the world needs a lower dollar. So they need to be very careful here because there's a lot of things, and they're too, they won't admit that they don't know, and they go in and they just don't go tiptoeing, and they go in large, and then they're trying to figure out what the real impact is. So I honestly think that if savings stays elevated, we're going to do what they promised they didn't want any part of, which was negative interest rates. But I don't know how else you're going to unlock all those funds, or at least attempt to unlock all those funds. So I would say negative interest rates first, where I wouldn't have said that before, but when I see those savings numbers, it makes me think that that might be the road to take.
I'm sitting here nodding my head because I am one of the, and I don't often quote polls because I don't put very much stock in them because they tend to be politically biased one direction or the other. But Gallup is not that. Gallup is the least biased of all poll takers in the country, according to Media Bias Fact Check, which I always check online. But they took a poll of the percentage of Americans who believed in the efficacy of masks. And it was 41% of college degree holders, and it was 58% of postgraduate degree holders believed in the efficacy of math. If you look inside of the spending tables, the top 40% of earners in America account for 61% of consumption, 61%. And that equates to 42% of U.S. GDP. So you have this massive cohort of Americans working from home, in many cases, flush with cash and not spending a dime of it. You've got velocity that has absolutely collapsed. And you've got MZM that has gone through the ceiling. And it's the picture of the Fed pushing on a string, because there's nothing that the Fed can do to force this cohort to spend money. Nothing at all.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And great point.
I'm sitting here nodding right back at you because, yes, and I'm an example. My kids who they got have been, you know, kept their jobs, and they, you know, they're not going anywhere. They are not going anywhere, and they're spending, you know, that means they're not taking their kids to movies, they're not playing in sports, they're not taking them to sporting events. They're not meaning to hoard money. There's just nowhere to spend it.
Yep, it's the Fed's worst nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. So and then I'm wondering, are they going to be forced to go in that, you know, because what are they going to do? And that won't guarantee it, as we've seen. So
the world. You cannot force people to spend money with interest rate policy. You can kill bank profitability, but you can bring a horse to water. You cannot make it drink. You cannot force spending no matter what the price of credit is.
Right. Right. Classic Schumpeterian definition of pushing on a string. And it's where we're at. And nothing says it more. The banks are so, you know, Chris Whalen does such great work. They're just so underperformed and they're not getting out from under this. Look at we've had a sizable stock market rally this week. The banks have gone nowhere. Nowhere.
Yep. And neither has the 10-year.
And that's right. And the European, which was under pressure because the news out of Europe had been better, today, I think, led the right back. We've had a sizable stock market rally today off of
false data.
Well, whatever the data showed, and where they try, and they turn around and now they're closing higher on the day, meaning lower yields. So, hello? So what is it?
Undefined. Undefined buy gold.
I'm sorry.
I said undefined buy gold.
That's right. You know what? And gold they tried to put away, couldn't do it. So somebody's worried about something more. And you know what? I would honestly say the world could use some commodity inflation because it would certainly help some of the emerging market countries. And I think that the Fed quietly pushes for that. And as we've talked about, I was on with Louis Gavet not long ago with Richard. And you know what? There's certain commodities that should perform well because where else are you going with your money? But that's why the stock market goes up. And I don't care what somebody's study says. You just have to put your money somewhere if you have money, and it goes into the equity market.
You do, Ira, but I'm not old enough to remember, and neither are you. But the last time in world history we had a commodity cycle be as protracted as it is right now was during the Great Depression. I'm just going to throw that out there.
You mean downward pressure on prices?
And persistent, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And interestingly, we really were in January of 2020. If you go look the first 2 weeks, commodities and the dollar was going down and the commodities were starting to percolate. I'm looking at the Bloomberg. I can tell you right now, the Bloomberg Commodity Index in January was up over 83, 84. In March, we went down to 58, 59, and we're just sitting here at 65.63. So although it is starting to perk a little bit with copper and, you know, again, if you actually got some infrastructure, some real infrastructure spending, the copper and a few others would be the first to find some footing, which would be a beneficial aspect. But again, there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle. But people have to be honest, and I don't think the Fed is honest with its intentions outside of we're probably not doing anything all the way through till December 2022. And I think it'll be far beyond that.
Well, great insight, Danielle and Ira. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Danielle?
Please go on quillintelligence.com. We have a retail product, the Daily Feather, And we also have an institutional broad offering of a weekly newsletter and investable takeaways and positioning ideas and what have you. But you can find information on both of those offerings at quillintelligence.com. And please do, if you don't already, follow me on Twitter at DMartino Booth.
Great. And Ira?
I'm kind of in the cave right now. You got to follow me on FRA and other podcasts that I'm doing. I was blogging, but I'm taking a little hiatus here because my, not editor, but the one who bounces stuff and corrects me on many things is with child. So I'm kind of stepping back here, giving her some time and myself. So I'm not sure, but you can find me here. So I've been doing a lot of these as well as with Anthony Credelli and a few other people. So just search them out.
Great. Thank you so much,
Danielle and Ira. Thank you.
Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.